Ben Moore is with us. Ben, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me today.
No problem. Glad to have you with us, and glad to have you with us as well out there. Again, if you'd like to get in on the conversation this morning, the number is 283-8414. Would love to hear from you this morning as well, talking about all things sport fishing here on the Kenai Peninsula. And I guess just to sort of get started, Ben, and first of all, I guess maybe I'll let you introduce yourself, because just to sort of frame this hour up, you know, way back at the beginning of the year, I had this idea, well, it's sort of winterish time, and we'll talk to some fishing guys and kind of break up the winter a little bit. And we spoke with Ken Coleman, and he's a commercial guy. Yep. And the idea was to speak with your predecessor at Cursa, Ricky Geese. He, of course, took another job, and that's what allows you to be here today. So I guess first, maybe just talk a little bit about getting into this new gig, and we can go from there.
Yeah, I'm super excited to be down here. I've been trying for the better part of 10 years to get moved down to the Kenai. I told my wife for a long time, like, we're going to leave Anchorage eventually, and it's either Ketchikan or Kenai for us. And
you'd been in Anchorage with Siri prior, right?
Yeah. I've been in Alaska 15, 16, something like that years. I came up to go to school at APU. I was an outdoor studies major up there, and worked for a couple years out on Prince William Sound as a kayaking guide. Goofed around in Anchorage for a couple of years, serving at restaurants and coaching middle school wrestling and things like that. And then fell backwards into a job working in the mining industry, and spent 7 years there. Left that to go run Senator Sullivan's campaign. I was his first campaign manager through the primary, and then took a job in Governor Parnell's office as his senior advisor on hunting, fishing, and public access issues. And then after that, yeah, the last three years or so had been with Siri. I was their surface estate manager. So dealing with all of their surface lands, which included significant pieces of the Kenai Peninsula borough and the peninsula itself.
A lot of stuff with that Siri nameplate on it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so, we had a lot of really good interactions from the Siri side of things with the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. Siri owns about 7% of the bank space between the Kenai Wildlife Refuge, so between Skelak and the mouth of the river. About 7% of that land is Siri land, and so making sure that we were taking care of that property in a responsible way, doing good conservation on it, but also allowing public access at the same time was one of my big projects, and something that I'm pretty proud of.
So something that kind of carries over into this new role, right?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, that's one of the things we did, was established a relationship with the Sport Fishing Association. So there's a couple of stretches of river that people really enjoy fishing on, and people were doing it in trespass for a very long time. So we set up a program so that you can come into the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association office, you can grab a Siri permit, and it's got a couple of stipulations, how they expect you to act and treat the land, and how to report bad actors out there. And that was a good relationship that we set up in partnership with CRISA to allow public access on those lands.
And we'll have time to get into a lot of the other different partnerships, especially when we're talking specifically about the Kenai River. And I'll try to broaden it out, because it's not just about the Kenai River, although that is kind of the major player.
Yeah.
Again, just starting out, maybe you could talk a little bit about, now that you've had some time to get a little...
I finally figured out where the coffee maker was this morning.
That's right.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Maybe you could give us kind of an overview of sort of the state of sport fishing on the Kenai Peninsula sort of in general, because, you know, we're coming out of a year last year that was not real good for anybody. And this year, I know that there's been some luck. Kasilov is having a great return so far, but things are a little slow on the Kenai. But how would you frame things up?
Yeah, and even Kasilov, it's not the current projections, I think, we're not going to go gangbusters over the goal limits.
Right.
We're going to come in at the top end of the range on the Kasilov. The Kenai has been really good. That first run of Russian River Reds, I think, tells a really particular story that I like to hang on to a little bit. But so far, the run is turning out to be okay. The Kings, I think we're going to hit the goals. And I think, that's been good. It's been limited to catch and release for sport fishermen on the river, which I think is actually a reasonable conservation, tactic to have out there. That comes with paired restrictions in the commercial fishery. But it's worked well so far. I think we're going to hit the goals on the Chinook, on the Kings, and the Reds. It's not going to be gangbusters. It's not outside. You know, it's not a huge run, but it's a comfortable run, I think, is how I would put it. The interesting thing that we're seeing on the Kenai this year is pinks in an off year. So it'll be really interesting to see if the department goes ahead and looks at those pinks, where they're coming from. Are they, you know, are they strays? Are they wild? What's going on with that stock of pinks that we're seeing? Some people are catching a lot of them. Some people are just one or two. I went out the other day to dip net with some friends, and about 10% of the fish that we brought in that day were pinks.
And yeah, I've been out. I was dip netting on the Kasilof and yep, brought in a couple of pinks, and that's all well and good. It's still pretty good fish.
Yeah, they smoke up really well.
That's great. Yeah. But I guess we'll go ahead and jump off there, because I know that's the pink salmon hatchery, especially down in Prince William Sound, is something that Kursa has been sort of fighting for a long time, and or certain aspects of that. And maybe you could talk about where that is.
Yeah, and this was before I came on board, but about a year ago. And there are a lot of misconceptions about where Kursa came down on that hatchery issue. What we were pushing for, and what I think we are maintaining, is that we asked for no increases to the releases that were going out of the Prince William Sound hatcheries until we have better science, until we understand what the stray rates are and what kind of impact those are having on our wild streams and our wild stocks. The hatchery program is important across Alaska. It's important for the commercial fisheries. I completely understand that. Sport fishermen make use of the hatchery programs, whether it's in Anchorage and the Hernandez sport fishery, or even stocking kings on Deep Creek and Anchor. So it's we're not wholeheartedly against hatcheries, right? But specific to an increase in more fish going out to sea from those Prince William Sound hatcheries, that's the thing that we had a problem with. We asked the Department of Fish and Game, we asked the board to just take a breath. Let's hold it as is and not do any new increases. So we got painted as being completely against, when instead I think it's more fair to say our position on the record formally with the Board of Fisheries was, let's take a breath and let's not do any increases to the releases that are going out there until we understand the science better.
Right. Because I think it's fair to say that, and especially from coming from a sport fishing perspective, pinks and hatchery pinks, for whatever reason, aren't really high on the list. So, you know, you look at your priorities and, you know, Kenai kings are like the bread and butter, and there are fewer and fewer of those all the time. Yep. And then you go down the list of sockeye, and there are questions about sockeye now all of a sudden. And so it becomes a bigger part of the conversation as things go along.
Well, and Kenai kings are really a hallmark species. I mean, this is an iconic species of fish. They don't grow this big anywhere else. They are not, the Kenai king is such a significant fish, not only to our economy, but also to our state and our identity of, this is the things that we produce. And it just happens to be in the most accessible fishery in Alaska.
And that can be a real double-edged sword,
good,
right?
And bad. Yeah. Yeah, I mentioned the Russian River, that first return this year when the department went to a bag limit of nine. Nobody in memory can remember a bag limit of 9, 18 in possession on that river. They probably would have gone to 12 if the parking lot and the infrastructure could have handled the people.
Right.
Because what that story tells me on the Russian was, when you have access to a fishery and when you have an abundance of fish available, Alaskans will show up. They will show up and harvest those with a hook and a line or however else you give them the opportunity to do that. And that's a lot of what Kursa fights for. It's a lot of what we stand for, is we want access, we want opportunity. And those are the two big things. And when it happens, you have people on the Russian that had never fished before. You know, folks that were borrowing gear from their neighbors in Anchorage to make a midnight run down just because they heard it was so hot and they wanted to give it a shot. They wanted to give it a try. And I think that's a great thing. It's a beautiful thing.
It can be, but again, it's that double-edged sword, because if you're an old hand at the Russian and you're not used to that big crowd, and all of a sudden you have a lot of rookies who are coming down, there's a way to fish in that area that is not written out in any guide. It's not, there aren't signs that say, here's how to do it. There's a lot of...
But what you also saw were a lot of those old hands teaching the new people. Taking a second, you know what, it's so hot out here, I know I'm going to hit at least as many fish as I would have gotten last year. There were a lot of folks that were teaching the new folks how to do it in a very encouraging way, you know, because there is a rhythm to that river, particularly down at the sanctuary, at the confluence. There's a rhythm to how people fish it. There's a just the way that everybody kind of whips the water there. And it's a, as much as people call it combat fishing, it's actually quite a friendly fishery, you know, and it's, even though you're shoulder to shoulder with somebody, they're more often than not, the interactions that people have out there are not confrontational, but more of, hey, are you new at this? Let me show you something. Let me teach you how to do this. And that works out great. And if you really, if you're like me and you don't like the shoulder to shoulder thing, there's plenty of spots up the river.
Well, it's one of those fisheries that, and like so many things, its reputation sort of precedes itself in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It's, but it's one of those really, it's one of those really cool experiences. When I talk about the importance of the sport fishery, catching the fish is only one small part of it. There's so much else that goes into why sport fishing is important to Alaskans. It's, you know, for the folks that are coming down from Anchorage or even coming up from, if you're coming from Soldotna to go fish the Russian, it's packing up your family and friends. It's making that run up there and fighting your way through. There's the front load experience. There's the actual activity of fishing. And then there's the years of stories that you get after it, that you get afterwards. These are all part of the, I want to say kind of the lifestyle or the culture that go along with sport fishing. And that, those are the important things. It's, but if there's no fish in that river, if there's no access to them, and if there's not an abundance of fish, people aren't going to take the time to pack up, to make those trips and to make those memories together.
Very good. Ben Moore joining us this morning here on the Kenai Conversation, Executive Director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. If you'd like to jump in on the conversation this morning, 283-8414 is the number. Again, 283-8414. And in talking about access, I feel like over the years in my covering fisheries of all the different stripes, whether you're talking sport fishing or commercial fishing, pretty much any organization and anything that they want to try to do for themselves has an opposition component to it, right? Yeah. There's a competing interests in all facets because everybody wants an equal shot at fish. There are only so many fish. There's only so many days in the year that they show up.
There's nothing like the fishing industry for folks to eat their own, right?
That's right.
Even on the sport side, the competition between whether it's dip netters, even dip netters from the shore, from boats, have issues with each other. Guided sport versus just personal sport, or individuals going out. There's a lot of challenges even within sectors. And then when you start to talk across sectors, when you talk sport fish in general, as compared to commercial fishing, yeah, we have a lot of love and desire for the same thing. And it's one of the challenges. When I took the job in Parnell's office, one of the things that somebody told me early on was, I said, so what's the big deal? What do you see the problem is with fisheries in Alaska? And he said, you know what it is it's infinite demand for a finite supply. Everybody wants it, and there's only so many. And there's a lot tied up in it, both on the sport and the commercial side. Everybody ties their culture, their lifestyle to the fishery in one way or another, particularly down here on the Kenai. It's not just the activity. It's everything about your life that goes into it. And that crosses all sectors.
Well, and specifically, not, you know, you say fishing broadly, but the type of fishing you do, whether that's commercial set netting, whether that's dip netting, whether that's flipping for reds on the Russian only and nothing else, whatever that is, you're into that particular type.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a handful of people that, you know, on the sport side that'll, you know, I'll dip net and I'll also hook and line. Like, I don't mind doing both. I like doing both, but I don't need a ton of fish for my family. So I'll happily go out there and help people haul some in with a dip net. But it was so special for me a couple of weeks ago to take my 5-year-old son out and catch his first fish on hook and line. Like, those are really important things. Some people just stay within their method of harvest. You don't have as much crossover as you would expect between methodologies, but it's there.
Yeah. So in talking about access, which of course is something that CIRSA really advocates for, that's one of those very touchy subjects, because when you're talking about either expanding an area that does have access already, or you're looking at new areas to let people get on a river, there's a lot of things that come with that. And I guess I'll kind of base this on the idea that, you know, the in-river part of things is what we can kind of wrap our hands around and manage really well.
Yeah.
And that portion of where the fish spend their time.
Yeah.
as opposed to out in the ocean where it's just an infinite amount of questions. But so when you're talking about access, be it on the Kenai or the Kasilof or wherever, what are the parameters that you're looking for to make sure that you're protecting habitat, that the people you are affording a new opportunity to fish understand what they're getting themselves into and those sorts of things? Is there a rule book for that?
So I wouldn't say there's a strict rule book that's been published or anything, but my predecessors at CRISA have done a great job, I think, in setting up some of those, what are the best practices for access along the river. So in river uses, you know, you go back to the 80s and 90s when we did restrictions on horsepower and engine types. You know, that was a method to help conserve the river from different types of pollution and erosion caused by higher horsepower motors. Along the banks, the light penetrating walkways and the stairwells that go into the river have been a big push that that CRISA has been behind. And they actually, I mean, they looked at it pretty closely when installing, you know, we worked really closely. My understanding is when we worked really closely with different public agencies. So when they were building those stairwells in, they were spaced pretty specifically. And I believe it's about 100 feet or so, because if you go beyond that, people will hop the fence and jump down into the river. But the walkways are all spaced out with about as far as people are willing to walk to get down into them. They're elevated walkways because that riparian habitat, that near shore habitat, is critically important to juvenile salmon. I mean, it's huge. And so cutting down on the compression from trails alongside the river and from erosion that happens, because those compression trails tend to become the new cut banks when erosion comes through. Those are things that we've been a big part of helping to repair. And then again, not to spend too much time on the Russian, but if you look at the Russian now at the ferry, think back 10 years and it was just a big dusty wall where the ferry came across. I drove past it yesterday and it's this big, beautiful wall of green now. That habitat restoration work was a partnership with Kenai River Sport Fishing Association and the Fish and Wildlife Service and the other management bodies in that area to start to restore some of that habitat in some of our heaviest used areas.
And I guess I'm looking for, recently I read a book called King of Fish by David Montgomery, and it's popular.
I'm familiar with it. I've got my criticisms, but yeah.
and everybody does. But my big takeaway from that is that, you know, you can look back almost 1,000 years and find out that and look at salmon management going back 1,000 years, and everybody always wants that. Some things never change. This is what I appreciate about the book, is it points out things that simply never change. And what that is essentially is human behavior never changes. As long as there are fish there, we're gonna want access to them. Give me some faith that we can continue to have access with them without destroying it.
Yeah. And that's one of the real challenges. And
it's a balancing act.
It's a huge balancing act. And on the sport side, part of it is, you know, it's an individual's evolution through the sport fishery, right? When I started fishing, let's take dip netting, for example. When I started dip netting, my first couple of seasons, dude, the bloodlust was strong, right? I just wanted to go out there and get as many fish as I could. Now, my family only needs like a dozen out of the dip net fishery, and I'll pull another 6 or 12 with hook and line. That's all we need. That's all my family's going to eat. And it's a personal discipline to make sure to take only as much as I need. When we talk about the dip net fishery there, that gets a lot of criticism from folks who see the thousands of Alaskans that are down there. But if you look at the harvest rate per permit down on that river, last year it was 12 per permit.
So 12 per permit, that's reported.
Yeah.
That's documented, right?
That's reported. This is the first year that I've only gone out once, but this is the first year that I haven't been checked. I've been inspected every single year that I've been on the river.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge when we look at fisheries models, and you look at the King of Fish and how we've managed our fisheries in the past, over the past 1,000 years or so. Largely, you know, one of the takeaways I have from that is when you have, when you've got interested onshore owners, like you look at the Scotland story and you've got wealthy landowners who owned a lot of the bank space, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of those guys were actually responsible for the conservation work that happened because they had a dedicated self-interest to making sure that those fish were coming back in. I don't really want to get into picking a fight right now with my friends in the commercial industry, but A lot of the overharvest comes from bad management practices over the last 100 years. Not saying that that's what we're doing in Alaska right now, but it's the story we need to learn from is that greed and that bloodlust, not just for fish, but also for the money that derives from them, that can be a challenge that we need to be able to moderate ourselves. So it's tough, but yeah, in Alaska, we're super lucky. We've been really, really lucky. We've got incredible habitat all over our state. People will say we have the best managed fisheries in Alaska. I know some detractors who say that we've just been darn lucky. And where we're at there is, it's a tough call. It's a tightrope. And the folks here at the Department of Fish and Game have a really, really difficult job to do. My impression of it, Commissioner Vincent Lang has been threading the needle this year. I think he's been doing a good job from the sport fishing perspective. We're really pleased with how things have been going.
Yeah, and commercial fishing time has been, as you mentioned earlier, with the king restrictions or paired restrictions in the commercial fleet, all as part of an overall conservation effort and everybody giving back a little bit.
Yep.
Well, as we're getting near the halfway point of the program, I guess we've been talking a bit about the Kenai River and the Russian River and access to those things. I'm curious, just specifically looking ahead, are there places where you do see an opportunity for more responsible access?
Yeah. One of the things that we've been looking at and was actually at the borough assembly meeting a couple of weeks ago. You've got 32 miles of that south bank of the Kenai River that doesn't have any public boat launch on it. So we're supportive of a new boat launch on the south side, on the Funny River side. It needs to be done in the most environmentally responsible way possible. We don't have a preferred location or anything like that. But it seems a little interesting to me that you can have someone out in Nikiski that's able to launch their boat faster than somebody that lives in Funny River and might only be 300 yards away from the river at a public facility.
Well, and that's, yeah, up and down that road, it's all about knowing a guy, really.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what it comes down to for a lot of folks. So I know that's a little bit contentious right now. And like I said, we don't have a preferred position or a preferred location out there. They've been looking at a handful of things, but that's one of them. I know the parks has been looking at an enhanced boat launch or boat retrieval facility down on the Kasiloth.
Mm-hmm.
That would be nice to see. It'd be fun to see if there's, you know, a better, safer way and a more publicly accessible way to be able to pull your boat out over there, something that's maybe ADA compliant, so more people can access the fishery. That'd be nice.
Some people, I think, appreciate sort of the challenge of figuring out what kind of a craft can I get into the Kasiloth right. River and yeah. then back out without getting stuck on the beach.
It is part, yeah, that's part of the fun. But as our state increases in the number of people that we have and the desire to access those fisheries, that's obviously going to have to evolve. We're not all on dirt roads in Alaska anymore. I love it that I do get to drive a dirt road to my house, but I also recognize that I'm glad there's a highway when I have to go back to Anchorage. Things are going to naturally evolve and make it easier for the public. This is the way it goes.
And the fishing on the Kasiloth that really has a lot of feelings one way or the other, because
yeah.
as pressure and popularity of the Kenai continues to increase, more people are discovering the Kasiloth River.
Oh, yeah.
Demand is going up there, and there isn't much infrastructure down there. There's not a huge capacity. There has been a fair amount of work on the north side.
Yeah.
On the south side, not so much. And you know, people, as you continue to develop that, you invite more people, and it becomes that question of how many people is too many people taking advantage of this resource all at one time.
Yeah. And this is the challenge of natural resource managers across our country is, on the one hand, you want to have as many people access, have the ability to access your resource, but you also know that increasing the number of people degrades your resource. So it's a tough balancing act to make.
Ben Moore joining us this morning here on the Kenai Conversation, talking about all things sport fishing as we're in really kind of the heart of the sport fishing season here on the Kenai Peninsula. You know, we're almost to the bottom half of the program. I guess maybe now would be a good time to take a little break. And then when we come back, coming up next February is 2 weeks of Upper Cook Inlet Finfish meetings, Board of Fish meetings in Anchorage. Should have.
Yeah, 2 weeks of fun.
It's 2 weeks of awesome. Fun. Should have been here. It's not. That's a conversation for another day, that whole rigmarole. But I think we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll get into talking some more of the policy things and some of the things that CIRSA is looking at in terms of that big Board of Fish meeting coming up in February.
Yeah, it sounds great.
Again, joined this morning with Ben Moore. He's the executive director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. We've been talking about all things sport fishing related here on the Kenai as we're in kind of the midway point of the fishing season. I don't know if you could tell by all the traffic out there and the long wait for a left turn anywhere, but that's where we're at, and that's what it is. As we get into the second half of the program, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Board of Fish meeting coming up. Regular cycle, and for folks who are familiar, that meeting was supposed to be in Kenai for the first time in 20 years, and they switched courses and made
it was originally selected for Anchorage.
Then they changed it.
Then they changed it back.
Right.
Yeah. So
for reasons that no one knows,
and that's under appeal again. But the big public process where everybody showed up and all the cities showed up with their chambers of commerce and whoever else to pitch their towns, the board at that point picked Anchorage.
Right.
And then in a quiet at the end of another meeting way outside of town, outside of the normal process, it was switched to Kenai. And then it was switched back after some public outcry. I know there's a lot of debate on whether or not it should be held in Anchorage or in Kenai, but as far as the process goes, the big pitch session where everybody went to go and say this is where it should be, it landed in Anchorage first, then quietly got switched to the Kenai, and then got switched back. So there's to clear up the misunderstandings there. Should it be on the Kenai? Should it not? That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying in the process, it was picked for Anchorage, then it was switched, and then it was switched back.
Would you have liked to have seen it in Kenai?
You know, I think one day, maybe, but right now it's a challenge. And selfishly, a lot of the sport fishing voices you've got issues in the Mat-Su Valley that are going to be addressed on the Upper Cook Inlet cycle. You've got issues in the Anchorage Bowl that are going to be addressed during the Upper Cook Inlet cycle, and down here on the peninsula that'll be addressed. So it's going to be a challenge no matter where it is. And I think I heard that it's under appeal right now anyways.
Yeah.
So given
all that, moving on to, you know, what's actually on the agenda, I guess I'm just curious broadly, you know, what are some of the policy, if not specific policy proposals, what are some of the policy areas that CIRSA is really paying attention to for this next cycle of meetings coming up?
Yeah. So a little bit of background, because I'm not sure that all listeners know about what the Board of Fisheries is, but Alaska's salmon resources are a shared state resource. They're a community property, for lack of a better term, right? Everybody has an interest in them as Alaska's fish. So it fell to the legislature to pick winners and losers and to allocate those fisheries amongst different users. Well, the legislature very early on realized that if that's what they were doing, that's all they'd be doing, and that's not a mess they wanted to get in. So they set up the Board of Fish and the Board of Game. The Board of Fish is responsible for setting up those allocations. They set the rules that the Department of Fish and Game has to manage within. So they set up those guidelines. They set up the management criteria. They set the fish are meeting their escapement goals. Those goals, those ranges are blessed by the Board of Fisheries. And so that's seven people who are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature to pick winners and losers. And that's the really hard part about the allocative process is they have a very challenging job of saying, here's how many fish go here, here's how many fish go there, this is how many we need back up the river. And it gets people really, really fired up. So,
and the thing that I hear from time to time about the Board of Fish process, insofar as there is a complaint about it, is that you have, especially talking specifically about the Upper Cook Inlet round of meetings, it's 2 weeks of, you know, long days of public testimony on hundreds of different proposals for all these different river systems.
Yeah.
And what I hear from time to time, and I think there's a lot of validity to it, is we're hearing from all these user groups and all these people, who's there to talk for the fish? Because even the managers and the biologists have a little bit of cover that they need to hide behind, because there are other considerations there. Who's there for the fish?
That's a good question. And you'll have a lot of people that say they're standing up to speak on behalf of the fish. Ideally, that should be the role of the Department of Fish and Game to say, here are the biological criteria that we need to meet to have sustainable fisheries, to have sustainable runs. That should be the role of the Department of Fish and Game. Yeah, you do have some scientists and some biologists who kind of hide behind, who may to some extent hide behind the sector that they're affiliated with. But in general, that is, it is understood and it's supposed to be that that's the role of the department to present science for the board to consider mm-hmm. in their management decisions.
Yeah. And then you hope that those decisions are made with the least amount of political what have you possible. And then that's always up for, that's what the debate is about.
That's a lot of what the debate is about because, and we mentioned it, I hope you don't mind, we mentioned it off air, mm-hmm. was when you're talking about managing fisheries, you're not telling the fish what to do. You're telling the people
right,
what to
right.
do and how the people can interact with these fisheries and who's allowed to take how many and what type of gear they're allowed to use and all that stuff. So, that's the big challenge the department has is they're managing people through this process with a lens towards how are we making either everybody happy, which is impossible, or how are we disappointing everybody at a relatively equal rate,
which is equally
much more likely.
Yeah. Much more likely, but not yep. necessarily any easier.
Still
because,
a challenge. Yeah. Yeah. Still a challenging art. So those seven people on the Board of Fish have a very, very challenging job.
Heading up to Anchorage in February, what are some of the sort of broad policy areas or proposals that CIRSA is looking at?
Yeah, so we've got a handful of plans in place. We've got some that are looking at the sockeye management plans for this area. We've got a king salmon management plan that we've put in as a proposal. We put in, I believe, seven different proposals to the board. Some of them are addressing more the targets. So when I balance it out, I look at the proposals in front of the Board of Fish through a couple of different lenses. Generally, you can lump them in as philosophy, targets, and tools. And some people just put proposals in that are philosophical about this is how we should be treating our fish. You guys figure out the details. A lot of our proposals fall into the targets and tools. What do we think the targets should be for the fisheries? And that would be, you know, one of our goals is increasing the number of fish in river above the sonar counter on the Kenai. We'd like to see more fish up the river. Again, going back to the Russian, with access and abundance, Alaskans are going to show up and harvest those fish, right? So that's one of our proposals is more fish up the river. And then different tools. You know, one of our proposals addresses the paired restrictions. We briefly touched on that earlier. Right now, when the Kenai is limited to no bait, then the set net fishery is limited to no more than 48 hours of fishing.
Right.
And there are other restrictions.
And
we're under that right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are other gear type restrictions. We do have a proposal addressing paired restrictions and actually asking for tougher paired restrictions, tighter locked in paired restrictions that give the department an additional tool as well.
What would that look like if it went through sort of as proposed?
So that proposal specifically, the proposal that we put out there, when we're limited to bait on, so when we're limited to no bait on the sport fishery, then the set net fishery would be at 24 hours. We propose a new tool for the department, and that is when there's a size limit on retention, that would drop the set net fishery to 18 hours. When it's catch and release, 12, and closed on the river is closed on the beach.
So more step-down measures. They're usually referred to as step-down measures.
Step-down, step-ups, whatever we want to call them. They're right. They're additional, more refined steps to the process. So that's one of the proposals that's out there. It'll probably get tweaked and put together. There's going to be people that are not happy about it, but that's one that's out there. We also have a proposal on coho. I think I want to say we have a proposal related to the 1% rule, pushing it to a 2% rule, and that is during the August fishery, if you have less than 1% of the total fishery of the total harvest 2 days in a row, that shuts down because it says it's the end of the harvest season.
Okay,
so it increases it from 1% to 2%. And we've got some that are asking for, you know, greater retention of coho for sport fish users. And then I've actually read through a lot of the proposals that are out there. There's a really interesting proposal out from the Valley that would like to see a dip net fishery for chum installed on the Susitna.
Is that a sizable run? I don't know anything about that one.
I don't know much about it either. But if the science would show that the fish are there, it'd be really interesting to see how a dip net fishery plays out on a river like the Susitna, which is mm-hmm. clogged up with a lot of trees, and it's a fairly swift river. But um, the this is the public process that we have, is anybody can submit a proposal to the Board of Fish, and it gets analyzed by the department. And as long as it's not completely cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, the board considers it, right?
Right.
And sometimes they'll pass on it. Sometimes they'll modify it. Oftentimes, it's rare for a proposal to fly through without any modification.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's why that meeting takes 2 weeks.
And Upper Cook Inlet takes 2 weeks because Upper Cook Inlet is such a different fishery compared to the rest of the state, where we have so many competing users and hundreds of thousands of people that have a direct personal interest in it.
And all different species of fish too, you know, yeah. And you can zoom in on that just on the Kenai, you're looking at all five species that you're trying to manage for in some capacity for all these different user groups.
Yeah. So it gets really complicated really quickly. Those guys have a tough job and they're there. They're not getting paid to do it. They're giving up a significant amount of their time to adjudicate these different proposals that are out there. But we're hopeful that our proposals are going to be successful. I think the targets and tools and where Chris is coming from to increase the fish available for Alaskans to go out there and get, that's a lot of what we're talking about from the advocacy angle.
You mentioned sport fishing for silver salmon, for coho, and I'm curious, you know, that's one that I think people, because it happens later in the year and the king run is more or less gone and the money fish have already come and gone. We don't maybe think about that as much. And I know that there's not as much science about the different coho runs as there are the king runs and the sockeye runs for those reasons. What would you like to see in that fishery, and especially for the science, so that those decisions can be made as soundly as possible? I guess, what kind of science would you like to see done so that you can help make some decisions or potentially make some different proposals?
Well, you know, obviously, anytime we have a better understanding of how many fish are coming back, that's going to help us out, right? And the challenges with those coho, especially in a pink year, you'll get fish of similar sizes, reds, cohos, and pinks that are all coming up past that sonar of a similar size. So making sure that the science regarding the apportionment of those fish, and what that is when all those fish come across the counter, they're just pretty much blobs. We're not taking pictures of them. We're getting sonar images off of them. So making sure that we have a good proportion of a good knowledge of proportionally how many of those are probably reds, silvers, or pinks would be important. But a better understanding of population and population dynamics is going to help any kind of management. That's really easy.
Mm-hmm.
That would be one of the first places I start.
And again, you know, looking ahead to the Board of Fish meetings coming up, I guess, are you looking for... You have a number of proposals. CURSA specifically is putting out there. But do you have, you know, what's the big goal? Is it a specific, you know, change in a king management plan? Is it a specific change to some other plan? What is the big one that you would be really focused on?
Like I said, we've got seven. There are a couple that are a little, maybe not quite as critical, but I think they're all put in for a reason. So I can't pick favorites on that. I can't pick favorites because each one of those proposals, both as a standalone and as a complete unit, they all have importance. They all have value to making sure that we're increasing the sustainability, the resiliency of the runs, particularly for sport fish users in Alaska.
And that's something else. You know, we're talking about escapement goals and those sorts of things. And you mentioned, you know, there's a ton of science that goes behind that. And there's a ton of work that goes on behind the scenes by the Department of Fish and Game and those biologists and those researchers to figure out those numbers.
Yeah.
But then those numbers get presented to the board and, you know, who knows what might happen. And sometimes those might be exactly what the science says. And other times it might kind of fudge it one way or another because you have these user interests. And do you see that playing out somewhere?
Well, you know, that's a challenge because the department can come and say, these are how many fish we feel need to return to the river within this range to make sure that we've got sustainable runs. And then what you're talking about is over the top of that, how many of those are going to be harvested? And that that's less of a question for the scientists and more of a question for the allocators, more of a question for the board. So as much as it might sound like, yeah, we can fudge those numbers a little bit, we may have arguments about when the department says we need X amount of fish to have a sustainable run on that river. You know, you might have, and Krista has in the past said, well, yeah, that's the bare minimum, but for a optimum, you might want this, which is X plus eight mm-hmm. or whatever. So we will have a little bit of back and forth on, well, yeah, your scientists say you need this much. We actually think you need this many to come back in because it's a biological science. It's fluid. So there's challenges there. But then beyond that, beyond the just baseline escapement rates, then we're talking about who's catching the leftovers. And that's where the big contention comes in. That's where you get the fights between the sport and commercial. And that's obviously where we're going to be standing up to speak on behalf of sport fishermen. And that's our role, is to sit there and advocate for as many fish as possible for Alaskans to go out there and harvest.
Right. You know, something that I wonder about as we come up to these Board of Fish meetings, I wonder about, changes to the calendar because, and I just recently did a story looking at the sockeye run and how delayed that is. You know, that's a 30-year trend that we're seeing play out, and that trend seems to be accelerating where that late run of sockeye to the Kenai River seems to be coming back a little bit later, a little bit later, a little bit later. And you have to start wondering, you know, at what point does our calendar for when people have access not match up? Because if you have a potential there to sort of artificially change that run timing.
Yeah, that's a big challenge. And we've seen that all over the state, sort of later run timings. We have late run timings where sometimes, oh, well, it's 3 days late, it's 4 days late, it's 5 days late. That's an in-season challenge that you have. And then sometimes, you'll hear this, oh, it's just a late run, it's a late run. And eventually, a late run becomes a weak run.
Mm-hmm.
But you won't hear anybody say it was a weak run until after it's all closed. And that is one of the things that that we get behind is, you know, we should be making the conservative calls a little bit earlier in the season. When we don't know where it's going to go, when there's some question mark about, God, well, are we just going to be squeaking over the goals for these fish, or are we going to be coming through them strong? I would say we should be making the conservative call earlier on to make sure that we've got those fish coming back in. And then when we know for sure we're going to meet those goals, then maybe we open it up a little bit. So that it's one of the challenges that's the department's challenge. Everything they've been doing this year has been operating within the management plans, within the guidelines. They're not doing anything special for anybody. Like I said, I think Commissioner Vincent Lang has been kind of threading the needle on that one, and he's been doing a good job. But it's the run timing thing is one thing. Admitting when a late run is actually a weak run is another challenge that we have. The shifting calendar, maybe that's something the department should take a look at. It's not something that we specifically got into on this cycle. But there's plenty of just, I don't know about empirical, but plenty of conversational evidence to say that overall the run timings have been shifting a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
for sure. You know, something else I kind of wonder about is we talked a lot about kings and there's always going to be pressure on fishing for king salmon. Always, always, always. And I wonder, you know, to what degree does it make a difference if you try to, I guess for lack of a better term, try to market some of the other species that are a little bit more robust and have slightly healthier runs. You know, where does that come into play where you're trying to as much as everybody wants to catch a great big king, where you're trying to de-emphasize that? And is that going on any level? I know it's going on some level with some folks.
Yeah, but it is going on some level. And you'll find that most personal sport fishermen, folks that are taking themselves out, many of them have shifted from kings to reds. Right. And a lot of the guiding outfits have had to, in order to survive, have had to shift from kings to reds. We've got harvest for fish under 36 inches available on the river right now. And it's been on a no bait, but still retention of the smaller fish. It wasn't that long ago, last year, the year before that, where we had bigger closures throughout the year. And in order for those businesses to survive, they've had to direct themselves towards the other fisheries. There's always going to be a market for going after king salmon. What I've seen is there are a lot of guides that have shifted, just personally, not being forced to, but have shifted from being a harvest outfit to being a catch and release outfit. They don't always make their clients do that, but you'll find a lot of guides that are out there that encourage their clients to put them back in the river. And that's fine to do. Chinook have a 93% success rate when you have catch and release. They've got about a 7% mortality. Catch and release works, and it protects the fish. My goal is to see that our Chinook numbers, our king numbers, come back to historic abundances so that we don't have to worry so much about, are we harvesting too many? Well, we've got enough so that we're not worried about it. Catch and release is a tool that is used to get there. I think it should be applied carefully by the department. And, you know, it's fine. The bait restrictions, I think, are helpful also. I have heard the criticism that people think that CRISA is all going to catch and release all the time. That's where we're pushing. That's not where we're pushing. What I'm pushing for is an abundance of fish in that river so that we can have normal, regular openers, so we can have a lot of fish and people can go out there and get them. If you choose to take them home and eat them, that's great. If you choose to let them go and run up the river and spawn, I hope you're letting the big ones go.
So in having a broad goal of reversing the low abundance, right?
Yeah.
What do you see as the key to that? What's the big linchpin that starts to make that happen?
Well, and this is when we get into some of those contention things,
right?
Contentious issues. It's my organization's opinion that there's too much commercial gear out in the water. So shortening the nets, at the commissioner's discretion, was done this year. I think that's a great first step. And we've actually seen the results of those shortened nets by having less Chinook bycatch in the set net fishery. Those guys on the set net fishery should be commended. If they're fishing with shorter nets and they're still pulling in a good number of sockeye and helping to support their families and letting those kings pass through, that's beautiful. That's what we want to see. But that's one of the elements is, just frankly, there's too much commercial gear in Cook Inlet. And it makes it a challenge, not only here, but also in the conservation corridor for the fish that are going up to the valley, because those fish are important as well. So that's one of the issues we see. Federal management of Cook Inlet is something that we're staunchly against. That's something that's been moved by some of our friends from USITA. That's something that we're very much not pleased with, is federal management of Cook Inlet waters. That should be a state fishery. So there's a handful of those things. More fish on the in-river goals is another one of our big goals, is to see more fish past the counter. And then strengthening the paired restrictions would be good. When the burden of conservation should be shared across all anglers, whether you're a sport angler or whether you're out there with a commercial net. So that's...
And I don't think we're going to have quite enough time to take in this call. I apologize for that. But in just about the minute or so... Finally piqued somebody's interest. We should have started off with that one.
That's all right.
In just the minute or so that we have left here, though, I guess I would ask, what's left to look forward to in the season?
So in the season, I think the king runs are going to be good coming in. I think we're going to meet our escapement goals. What the department decides to do with that is up to them, but we're comfortable with the management criteria that are in place right now and on bait restrictions. The sockeye, like I said, I think are going to come in at a moderate number. It's not a gangbusters year, but it's also not something to, you know, I think we'll be in the mid to lower range of the projections. So that's pretty good. I anticipate a lot of pressure on the Kasiloff is going to stand both on the sport and on the commercial side. And then we're going to move into the fall pretty quickly into coho runs. And that's, you know, things get exciting with around coho and we find a whole new, emerging class of fishermen in the trout fishery on the Upper Kenai River, which is going to start growing in September and October. So an exciting year going into the fall. And then we get in the Board of Fish cycle immediately. We're talking about Prince William Sound. We're talking about all kinds of places, really gearing up towards that February Board of Fish meeting on Upper Cook Inlet. That's going to be the real challenging part for a lot of people.
Well, maybe as we get a little bit closer to that, you and I can find some time and sit down again, and we can really zero in on some of those policy questions, and we'll have some time to take some of those calls if folks want to tune back in.
Absolutely. Sounds great, man.
All right, great. Ben Moore again joining us this morning. Thanks again so much for being here, Ben.
I really appreciate it. I'm so happy to be down on the peninsula, and I'm so happy to be here with you today. Thank you.
Very good. Ben Moore, Executive Director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association, with us this morning on the Kenai Conversation.